even more ironically, is that these Slava-class cruisers, of which the Moskva was one, was built in Mykolaiv shipyard. Just think about that. And it's named for the capital, the national capital of Russia.
Now, you talked about this being humiliating for Russia, and it surprised a lot of people how fiercely Ukrainian forces have been able to fight back this huge army. The loss of this ship, what does it say about Russia's military performance in its war in Ukraine?
Well, I think it's a carryover of what we've seen in the land campaign. And this ship, the Moskva, carries the Caliber-class cruise missile, which was used in combat operations by the Russians. It also carries a surface-to-surface missile that can engage other ships. But it also has defensive systems that can defend the ship. What it tells me is that the Russians were complacent. They should have been able to defend their ship, but I think they thought they could operate in the Black Sea or the Sea of Azov with impunity. And when you're in a wartime scenario, you need to be at battle stations. Obviously, they were distracted by something, if in fact this was a missile strike, and allowed their ship to be hit. And then even further, as far as how they operate, damage control had to be poor on the ship. You know, the United States Navy has had its fair share of accidents or incidents. The USS Stark was hit by an Exocet missile in the Arabian Gulf back in the 80s, and we've had some collisions recently. We didn't lose any ships because we have sailors that know how to do damage control and chief petty officers, non-commissioned officers, who can take care of emergency or crisis on board the ships. Mm-hmm. This tells me that the Russians don't have the same level of proficiency.
Well, let's talk about the capacity of the Russian army. Do they still have the capacity to take over cities that are strategic coastal cities? I'm thinking of the southern port city of Mariupol, which Russian forces are besieging and have been trying to take for weeks now.
Right. And since they were not able to get in there with their naval infantry and actually take over the city, they've just decided to destroy the city. They've also been unable to take over Mykolaiv, that shipyard I was talking about, and they have not touched Odessa. Odessa will be a very tough fight if they go ashore. They might get their Marines ashore. They've got these Rapuchka-class amphibious assault ships, but they won't get very far because of the fierceness of the Ukrainian fighters. And they've got to be worried now that if there is an anti-ship cruise missile like the Neptune, which they claimed hit the Moskva, that all of their ships are in jeopardy when they come close to the shoreline.
You also mentioned flagships are your best ship, right? But this is a 40-year-old ship that was sunk. What does that say about Russia's Navy?
Well, it says that, they've got the same kind of budget problems that everybody else's Navy has. So they put their resources, the Russians put a lot of their resources into the submarine force. And I'm a submariner, and I know that for a fact. Mm-hmm. They poured rubles into the undersea domain because they see that as an asymmetric threat against the West. They have six Russian Kilo-class submarines running around the Black Sea right now. They're pretty new, and so they've recapitalized that force. But they have ignored the carrier fleet, the Kuznetsov is in dry dock, and they haven't paid as much attention to their surface navy. And this is a wake-up call for them.
Overnight, Russia says it struck a Ukrainian defense plant that makes missiles, including anti-ship missiles. So Russia says missiles didn't take down its ship, then it hit a plant that makes anti-ship missiles. So does this lend credibility to Ukraine's version of what happened to the Moskva?
Well, that's quite a coincidence, isn't it? And I would think that I've also seen that the retaliatory strikes overnight have been brutal on the cities around the coastline, Sea of Azov, and all the other areas that the Russians are occupying. So, yes, it would tend to indicate that the Ukrainian story of a two-strike anti-ship cruise missile on Moskva is indeed accurate.
That's retired Admiral James Fogo, former commander of the U.S. Naval Forces in Europe and Africa. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Layla. Thank you.
Next, we have news of the comeback of a virus. When the global effort to eradicate polio began more than three decades ago, about 350,000 children per year were paralyzed by polio. But thanks to a robust vaccination effort, that number dropped into the dozens by 2016. Now cases have started to go back up. Here's NPR's Ari Daniel.
Eliminating polio is complicated. Scientists have tried outmaneuvering the virus, but they haven't fully succeeded. Raul Andino is a virologist at UC San Francisco.
viruses rapidly evolve. They are masters changing to overcome any kind of challenge that they encounter.
Andino says these genetic gymnastics are a big part of why polio has remained so elusive to defeat. In the U.S., which is polio-free, children get injected with a series of shots containing inactivated poliovirus. But many other parts of the world rely on an oral vaccine made with living, weakened virus. It's a one-time dose that confers lifelong immunity, quick and cheap. But there's a problem.
Sometimes it actually reverts and starts to cause disease.
The virus reverts. It can become virulent again, even leading to paralysis in some cases. To be clear, not in the person who is vaccinated.
No.
Getting the polio vaccine does not give you polio.
No.
So the vaccine is safe.
Yes.
But those who've been immunized with the oral vaccine can shed live virus in their stool. In places with poor sanitation, the virus can spread through sewage, where it can become virulent again. And if someone who isn't vaccinated comes in contact with contaminated wastewater, they could become sick with polio, vaccine-derived polio. Gaps in immunization create more opportunities for the unvaccinated to become infected.
These vaccination campaigns have been certainly affected by the pandemic. And also the focus of everybody is looking into SARS-CoV-2 rather than polio.
So Andino and his collaborators developed a new oral polio vaccine, one that still contains a weakened version of the virus, but that they hobbled even further.
What we did is three independent modifications.
Which Andino says makes reactivation way less likely. This new vaccine, after performing well in clinical trials, was approved for emergency use by the World Health Organization, which says 265 million doses are now being rolled out in 14 countries, primarily in Africa.
This is not the first time we've heard this new vaccine is going to solve everything.
Svea Klosser is a medical anthropologist at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, who studies vaccination programs with a focus on polio.
On the other hand, if you have an oral polio vaccine that truly doesn't cause vaccine-derived polio, it really could be wonderful. It's something that we'll probably need in order to secure eradication eventually. So I'm hopeful. Skeptical, but hopeful.
Uganda is one of the countries that's embraced the new vaccine. Sabrina Chitaka works as an infectious disease pediatrician at Makerere University in Kampala.
You just need to have one child with a vaccine-derived polio infection, and before you know it, it's the rest of the continent.
Chitaka says there have been no vaccine-derived polio cases reported within Uganda, but the virus was detected in wastewater, and officials worry about refugees coming from conflict zones in neighboring countries where vaccination programs have lapsed. Chitaka says in just 2 weeks in January, Uganda vaccinated more than 8 million children with the new vaccine, with no side effects reported.
For us as pediatricians, as researchers, we think that this is going to be part of the end game to end polio in the whole world. I am optimistic, but I'm not yet comfortable that we are out of the woods.
Ari Daniel, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's 19 past 8 now. It's Friday, and later this hour we'll hear Wisconsin Life, the story of a semi-pro football team that played for 3 decades in Wisconsin, not too far from Lambeau Field. That's coming up in 25 minutes.
China's first quarter growth figures are going to come out soon, but between COVID lockdowns and shakeups due to the war in Ukraine, how's the economy holding up? I'm Rima Khreis, the GDP over there. Next time on Marketplace.
You can hear Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra.
performing Beethoven's Emperor Piano Concerto with soloist John O'Connor on Friday, April 22nd in the Capitol Theater. Tickets are at overture.org.
This is Lily Maselli. I am the host of In Between the Music on WGTD HD1. My show is a blend of music and a bit of trivia. For dates and times, go to WGTD.org and click on Program Schedule.
And breezy in the south today, cloudy for the rest of the state with scattered snow showers. The northeast might see some rain as well, highs from the low 30s to the mid 40s. On Saturday, sunny in the south, a mix of sun and clouds elsewhere in the region, and highs from the upper 30s to the mid 40s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the University at Buffalo, an AAU public research university, where pharmacologists and neuroscientists are working to develop a treatment for chronic pain. More at buffalo.edu/NPR. From Avast, a global cybersecurity company with more than 435 million users, Avast is dedicated to helping people take control of their safety and privacy online. Learn more at avast.com. And from Fisher Investments Wealth Management, offering guidance on retirement income, Social Security, and estate planning. More at fisherinvestments.com. Clearly different money management. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. With Supreme Court rulings on high-profile, controversial cases expected soon, and with a new associate justice headed for the high court, questions about recusals are front and center. The court's newest justice, Ketanji Brown Jackson, has already said she'd recuse herself from a Harvard affirmative action case coming before the court because she sits on Harvard's board of overseers. And there's a brewing controversy around Justice Clarence Thomas because of his wife's texts about the election. But the Supreme Court has different rules than lower courts, and only the justices have the final say and whether they will step aside from a case. I asked Louis Varelli, a law professor at Stetson University, about past recusals and what it takes to change a Supreme Court rule.
There is no way to hold a justice directly accountable for a failure to recuse or for a recusal decision that shouldn't have been made that was inappropriate. And there has never been. There is a law that says a justice shall recuse under certain circumstances. It's the same law that applies to lower court judges in the federal system. The justices generally pay homage to that law, but do not apply it strictly to themselves. And there's a reason for that. When you recuse a Supreme Court justice, that justice cannot be replaced. Lower court judges are replaceable. So you change the number and makeup of the court when you recuse a justice from a decision.
Okay, so then let's specifically talk about the decision by this newest justice to recuse herself from a case on affirmative action at Harvard, where she sits on the board. That will definitely change the makeup of who decides, and it will change possibly the outcome of that decision. So how impactful will it be that she's recused herself in this case?
It could be very impactful. Now, I think the general consensus is it's unlikely to change the outcome in this particular case, given the questions presented in this court. But her decision represents the kind of balancing that Supreme Court justices always have to do, and that is a justice has to decide whether it's more important to have a fully constituted court for a given case, or it's more important for them to make an ethical decision about their involvement and remove themselves.
There are some that would say it should change. You know, there are critics that say there should be a more hard and fast rule so that people pull themselves out or stay in, not on a discretionary basis. Is that a view you agree with, disagree with?
I generally disagree with the notion that a code of ethics would help. There's been 18 bills introduced in Congress since 2011, by my count, applying a code of ethics to the justices. And my response is that there is a binding law on the books that tells justices when to recuse, and they have all consistently treated it as advisory. Several justices of all ideological stripes have testified before Congress and said, that a binding code won't work for the justices because the decision is so context specific. So adding a code of ethics on top of a binding law that currently isn't achieving our goals strikes me as highlighting a problem without providing a solution. It would just create another set of standards that the justices will apply contextually and leave us where we currently are.
And you talked about how it's always been like this. This isn't a surprise. This is how the court works, and there are reasons for that. But we're also operating in a very highly politicized moment in the country where people are questioning institutions and whether they serve the public. And so in this moment, is it different when you have, for example, the loudest voices calling for Justice Thomas to recuse himself on the left, those even before the confirmation happened for Ketanji Brown Jackson, there were calls for her to recuse herself in the case that she ultimately has already decided to recuse herself from. Will people's faith in the court be chipped away at?
Potentially, yes. And of course, Justice Barrett faced the same questions about recusal involving an election case because she was confirmed right around the election. And then the biggest concern is the one you raise. Public perception of the court's legitimacy is unquestionably the thing that is in most peril as we become more ideologically divided and as questions like those confronting Justice Thomas sort of become public. I think there are lots of reasons for Justice Thomas to recuse around cases that could involve his wife's communications or his wife as a witness or his wife's conduct. And I think those as an ethical matter and as a constitutional matter are easy questions.
And just to give people context, his wife, Jenny Thomas, her texts were revealed. She had strong opinions. She was there on January 6th before the actual attack.
That's right. If a case would arrive before the court that involved Jenny Thomas's conduct, and certainly, of course, if she were a witness, then I would think not as a matter of statutory law necessarily, but as a matter of constitutional law, as a matter of due process, Justice Thomas would be required to recuse himself. And of course, that leads to the question, what if he doesn't?
Right.
And the reality is we don't have a way to enforce that beyond impeachment. And how profound of a violation would we have to discover in order to inspire a movement for impeachment, let alone the political realities that would likely weigh against impeachment, right? We are not in a political environment where impeachment and removal are likely. That is the only constitutional remedy against justice. They could do this to themselves. So the court could adopt its own code. That's easy. But that's highly, highly unlikely based on my research of past comments and conduct by the justices. The justices do not want to be seen as removing one another from cases.
So in this case, right now, what is the danger around whether to go with one public opinion or the other in a very polarizing case when it comes to making your decision as to recuse or not to recuse?
Right. So when I talk about public opinion, it's really public perception, public confidence in the court. So the current state of political divisiveness in America may very well counsel for a dramatic change in the way the court operates. That has to happen through constitutional amendment or through the justices themselves. Congress doesn't currently have the power to do that because of the way the separation of powers is structured in our Constitution and the way it works. Requiring recusal simply hasn't worked, not because the justices aren't recusing, but because they're not recusing based on the statute. It's possible to create different structures through constitutional amendment where there are checks on the court, but that's the only obvious way to create constraints on the court that are enforceable, that don't currently exist.
That's Louis Borelli, a professor at Stetson University College of Law. This is NPR News.
Leaving everything behind and wandering in search of a new home, that is the story of Passover, which begins tonight. It's also the current reality for Ukrainian Jews who fled the war.
In shelters, in refugee camps, or synagogues, doesn't matter. We will celebrate anyway.
I'm Elsa Chang. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune in for All Things Considered, starting at 4 this afternoon here on Wisconsin Public.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
Thanks for tuning in for Morning Edition on WPR. In news, Wisconsin's unemployment hit a record low in March, according to preliminary numbers released yesterday. We'll have more on that story and all the latest Wisconsin news for you in just a minute after an update from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Amy Held. In the 50 days since Russia invaded Ukraine, the UN has recorded more than 4,500 civilian casualties. That includes scores of children. Incalculable suffering, but Irina Venediktova, Ukraine's war crimes prosecutor general, is charged with tracking it. So, she says, President Vladimir Putin and his Russian forces will pay for what they have done.
I protect public interest of Ukraine. I protect public interest of Ukrainian citizens. And now I see that I can't protect these dead kids. And for me, it's a pain.
Ukraine's defense ministry says Russia is for the first time using long-range bombers on the southern city of Mariupol. And fighting is underway around steel and iron works in the port area. Meantime, trapped residents are being starved to death. That's what the head of the UN's World Food Program tells the AP. The Mariupol City Council says Russian forces are exhuming bodies but not allowing residents to bury their dead. Protests broke out in Grand Rapids, Michigan yesterday.
What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
The family of Patrick Leoya is calling for criminal charges against the still unnamed police officer who fatally shot the 26-year-old as he lay on the ground after fleeing a traffic stop. His family had fled violence in their native Congo 8 years ago. It's NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. Wisconsin's unemployment rate dropped to a record low 2.8% in March, according to preliminary numbers released Thursday by the Department of Workforce Development. The numbers come from a monthly survey of Wisconsin residences conducted by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Department of Workforce Development Chief Economist Dennis Winters says part of the reason the rate went down is that the estimated number of people employed increased to nearly 3.1 million.
That's a record high for the number of people employed in the state of Wisconsin. So it's higher than pre-pandemic and higher than any number we've had going forth. And part of that is, you know, people are back to work, the economy's growing.
The state unemployment rate was well below the national rate of 3.6% in March. The State Department of Natural Resources has restarted efforts to set standards for bacteria in groundwater after conservatives on the agency's policy board halted the attempt in February. The Wisconsin State Journal reports that the board on Wednesday authorized a public hearing and comment period on a new rulemaking process to set groundwater standards for E. coli bacteria. DNR officials spent 2.5 years developing rules setting groundwater standards for E. coli, PFAS chemicals, and other pollutants, but the board scrapped the work in February. The board's conservative majority said then that they were concerned about the state getting ahead of federal regulators setting PFAS standards, as well as the cost of compliance, and killed the entire rules package. Yesterday's high winds caused some damage around the state. The Journal Sentinel reports that one of the windows of the Chase Tower in downtown Milwaukee was broken. Police closed the sidewalks in the area as glass fell from 15 floors up. Authorities in Beloit said power lines downed by the wind probably caused a house fire that displaced a family there yesterday. That's according to the State Journal. Downed lines also closed a stretch of Highway 81 in both directions in the area for a few hours. The Wisconsin Department of Transportation docked the Merrimack Ferry yesterday because of the wind. Mitchell International Airport in Milwaukee recorded a wind gust of 55 miles per hour. The Milwaukee Brewers urged fans who planned to tailgate before the home opener not to set up tents or canopies for the sake of everyone's safety. You're listening to news from Wisconsin Public Radio. Find more at WPR.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from your part-time controller. Your part-time controller is hiring accountants to assist nonprofits while working from home and at client offices, full or part-time. More at yourparttimecontroller.com. And from Workday, committed to helping organizations adapt to change, using real-time data to uncover insights, stay decision-ready, and prepare for whatever's next. The finance, HR, and planning system for a changing world.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Russia's president is answering Western sanctions by saying they failed. Vladimir Putin made that case in numerous speeches. He spoke after the U.S., the European Union, the U.K., Japan, and some other nations, which represent a giant share of the world economy, closed off much business with Russia. So what's Putin's case? NPR's Charles Maines is in Moscow. Hey there, Charles.
Hi there.
What do the sanctions feel like where you are?
You know, it's been quite a ride. When sanctions kicked in, the currency, the ruble, cratered. That sent people scrambling for dollars and euros. Then we saw a run on goods, mainly out of fear of inflation or that items might disappear. You know, some of them you might expect, like iPhones. Others were more surprising, like sugar. But these days, most items are back on the shelves, only prices are way up. And of course, there's also been this exodus of foreign companies from Russia, so that's meant a lot of shuttered storefronts. But all that said, the ruble, it's back, you know, almost to where it was before the conflict began. And now that's thanks to government efforts to prop it up artificially, and of course, money pouring in from Russian energy exports, which are huge. But all this has created this kind of weird sense of normalcy here, although I really hesitate to use that word given the conflict.
Has Putin played up that sense that there's nothing to see here?
Yeah, you know, in this week in multiple settings, he was defiant and made the case that what he called the blitzkrieg of sanctions had failed. You know, Putin's basic message was they present Russia with opportunities to become more self-reliant and to build new partnerships. Let's listen in.
But the economy...
So Putin's here is saying that economies always adapt, and if you can't find something in one country, well, you go to another, and it's unavoidable. And so Putin's idea is that what Russia can no longer get from the West, it can now get from China or India, and that what Russia currently sells to the West, you know, mainly gas and oil, it can provide to new, friendlier markets if it comes to that.
Well, can Russia pivot its whole economy to places like China and India then?
Well, experts aren't as optimistic. They say these sanctions will be devastating and it's just too early to see. At least that's the view of Natalia Zubarevich. She's a specialist on Russia's regional development with Moscow State University. So Zubarevich calls these sanctions a genuine shock to the Russian economy, but she says we'll only feel the real impact starting in May or June when she says production lines will break down. Now, she argues the reason for that is imported parts. Most of what's made in Russia comes from at least some component made in the West, often specialized and high-tech, which China can't provide, at least not right away. And so without these parts, work will just stop. She says in car factories, in offshore drilling for gas, in airplane manufacturing, and so on. And of course, all this impacts people's lives.
Well, let's talk about the people. To the extent that you can tell, what are ordinary Russians thinking about sanctions?
Well, we sort of know. Polls will tell you that a vast majority of Russians, over 80%, support Putin's policies in Ukraine, although most only have access to state media. That's important because that media presents the view that these sanctions are the West trying to keep Russia down. You know, in conversations I have, at least, I also hear another view. People say this will all be over soon. You know, give it a few months and everything will go back to normal. How realistic that is questionable, but it's a view the Kremlin can certainly live with, at least for now.
NPR's Charles Maines is in Moscow. Thanks.
Thank you.
One of the nation's most visible anti-Trump Republicans has moved to a rural, deep red Kansas town. Now, Stephanie Grisham wants her new neighbors to rethink their support for the former president. Frank Morris of member station KCUR reports.
Stephanie Grisham stands squarely with Donald Trump on gun rights and immigration. She was a true believer, signed on to the 2016 campaign, and served 4 years as First Lady Melania Trump's press secretary, doubling as White House press secretary part of that time. But Grisham says she gradually soured on Trump. Then, when Melania Trump refused to condemn the violence of the Capitol insurrection, Grisham quit, packed up her two little dogs, and moved to Plainville, Kansas.
It was just this really peaceful place that I thought would be a perfect place to kind of get over Trump world.
Plainville is a remote little prairie town where people tend to work long hours in hard physical jobs. Grisham's not from here, but her sister married a local guy and lives here with her two kids. Grisham bought an old house across the street from her sister and fixed it up.
Then I started to write my book, and I kept thinking, like, oh, what's going to happen here? Am I going to have, like, Trump signs in my yard one morning, or, you know, I'm not going to lie. This is a very big Second Amendment part of the country. And so I'm not going to lie that I thought, like, should I learn how to shoot a gun myself? Do I need protection? You know, I mean, those thoughts went through my head.
That's because she wrote a book that paints a very unflattering picture of Donald Trump.
I mean, he's the ultimate con man.
And then she went on TV to promote that book.
On January 6th, she saw a lot. Now she's saying a lot. Her bombshell new book is already trending.
She's got to be all kinds of brave to do what she did.
That's Plainville Times editor Candace Rachel. She says Trump won this county with 86% of the vote in 2020, and that many here adore the former president.
He's it. A lot of people in this town think he's the savior.
Shame on you.
And it's Francis Benedict.
In a small town like Plainville, a new face stands out. And at the Shortstop gas station, a lot of people are just glad someone moved in here and fixed up a house. But others, like Lori Smith, are leery of their new neighbor.
We just heard that she worked for Trump, and then she kind of, like, basically turned on him or something, or said all of his bad stuff, I guess.
Grisham gets around Plainville. She shops at the farm supply store, frequents the two restaurants, and attends school sporting events. The town veterinarian, Lauren Mack, says Grisham keeps a relatively low profile.
It cracks me up sometimes because I'm like, well, it's kind of a big deal, but all right. And out here, nobody really cares. She hides in plain sight here.
But Grisham toggles back and forth between relative obscurity in Plainville and being a minor celebrity on national TV. Recently, she co-hosted ABC's The View and tried suggesting that denigrating Trump supporters, like her Plainville neighbors, only strengthens political divisions.
We can't call people Republicans these names. Like, you can't denigrate my neighbors.
Marjorie
in the Midwest
Taylor Greene is an idiot.
Stephanie Grisham says her neighbors deserve respect, and she's crafting a message for those who continue to embrace Donald Trump.
And I want to say I understand that. I thought he was amazing. But I promise you, he's not in your corner. He's in Donald Trump's corner, period.
If the ex-president runs again and wins, Grisham says she thinks Trump would use a second term to exact revenge on anyone who's not in his corner. That is, people like her. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Plainville, Kansas.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:42 now, and you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in 9 minutes, a football league that collapsed spectacularly in the 1980s returns on Saturday. A. Martinez talks to author Jeff Perlman about the rise and demise of the USFL the first time around.
Explore how lasers can help combat cancer and how soil can lead to the discovery of new antibiotics in PBS Wisconsin, Education's newest resource. Meet the Lab, an online collection of educational resources for middle school science classrooms. Funded in part through the Timothy William Trout Education Fund, the full collection is available for free use by teachers, educators, and families at pbswisconsineducation.org.
Contributors to WPR include UW Health, an L. Johnson Swedish restaurant and boutique. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. Details can be found at wpr.org/sponsor.
WGTD-FM is now available on your smart speaker. Simply say, play WGTD on TuneIn and hear WGTD programming. 24/7 Jazz is also available. Simply ask, play WGTD HD2 on TuneIn.
You're listening to Morning Edition on WPR. Here's some of what's happening in the news. The British government says it plans to start putting asylum seekers on one-way flights to Rwanda within weeks. It's defending the controversial plan, which has outraged refugee groups and humanitarian organizations. The Maine legislature has taken the first vote in giving the state's tribes the same rights enjoyed by federally recognized tribes across the country. The House voted to restore rights forfeited by tribes in the Maine Indian Claims Settlement Act of 1980, which made them subject to state law. We'll have all the latest news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio coming up just after 9. The National Weather Service has issued a snow squall warning for eastern Menominee County, northern Wapaka County, southern Oconto County, and Shawnee County until 9:30. And a dangerous snow squall was located 7 miles southwest of Kashina, and the visibility apparently can drop to zero in this kind of squall.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of Align Probiotic, a daily supplement to support digestive health, containing a probiotic strain developed by gastroenterologists with 20 years of research. More at AlignProbiotics.com. And from Indeed, committed to helping businesses attract, interview, and hire candidates. Businesses can invite candidates to apply, then schedule and conduct virtual interviews all in one place. Indeed.com/NPR.
It's 8:45 now and time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maury McCollum with the answer to an audience question about a historical football team.
Gene Jansen wrote to Wisconsin about the Little Chute Flying Dutchman, a semi-pro football team that played for three decades, a mere 25 miles from Lambeau Field. He remembered the team from his youth and hoped to learn more about its history. With his help, WPR's Jenny Peek hit the archives to learn more.
When Gene Jansen was a boy, he spent many Sunday mornings helping ready the field for the Little Chute Flying Dutchman, his town's very own semi-pro football team.
We'd go to the lumber yard, and that's where we'd get the line and at this machine and put the lines up, and all the yard markers had to be 17 and a half inches in from the sidelines, you know. And it took a long time because you had 50 yards one way and 50 yards going the other way.
That was in the late 1940s, but the team got its start in 1920. Over the years, the Flying Dutchman played teams across central and northeast Wisconsin. And while the Dutchmen were able to suit up as a team for 30 straight years, other teams came and went.
After the war, there was other teams that had not have a team because of the war, took a lot of their players away. Fortunately, in Little Chute, we were able to keep going because the St. John's High School was giving teams that the players could keep playing. And so a lot of those players went on to play for the Flying Dutchman.
So what were some of the teams the Flying Dutchman played?
The main four teams was Manitowoc Gales, the Two Rivers Ramblers, and Little Chute, and the Merrill Foxes. I think it was, believe, in 1938. Later on was the New London Edisons, the Clintonville Four-Wheeler Drive Truckers, and the Appleton Reds.
But the Dutchmen didn't just play semi-pro teams. Legend has it they also played the Green Bay Packers.
I was able to trace it to 1920. By talking to some of the guys, I heard it was 52 to nothing that Little Chute got whomp. However, when you read more, it shows where one of the teams actually beat the Packers. I think it was the 1935, you know, like an exhibition game or something like that. The only one of a semi-pro team that ever beat the Packers.
Jansen says fans of the Little Chute Flying Dutchman even tailgated like the Cheeseheads of today.
When they played ball at halftime, where did some of the crowd go at halftime? Where the heck are those guys going? Well, here they're going across the road about a block away, and this guy had a garage, and he had beer in that garage with coolers. And those guys would go over there and get a can of beer, you know. And he had his whole garage lined up with all different kinds of beer cans, different brands. I think that's how he got his collection.
The team disbanded in 1950. Jim Bunger is now 91, played toward the end of the Flying Dutchman's reign.
And I played with Dutchman 47, 48, 49. I played tackle and guard most of the time, both ways, on defense and offense.
But like many of his teammates, Bunger's had to eventually say goodbye to football.
In 50, I got married. Well, then football was over with for me. Yeah, I couldn't take a chance on getting hurt more or anything after I got married. Oh, I really enjoyed playing the football net. But it's just after you get married that you don't play that anymore.
Now 81, Jansen hopes to pass along some of the history he remembers so fondly.
Like I said, it was crowds like sometimes 3,000 people at that game because, you know, years ago, there was no television, you know, and that's how it was. Everybody went to a game. People followed everything. And now it's hard to get people to get involved, even volunteering. You know, it's keep things going that you used to belong to. I love helping people, and I just, this is history that people should know.
You gotta be a football hero to get along with a beautiful girl.
This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Lily Maselli. I am the host of In Between the Music on WGTD HD1. My show is a blend of music and a bit of trivia. For dates and times, go to WGTD.org and click on Program Schedule.
Please to support the arts in our communities. Find out more at WPR.org/events.
In sports, the Brewers opened their home schedule with a 5-1 victory over the St. Louis Cardinals yesterday. Game 2 of a 4-game series is tonight. The 3rd-seeded Bucks will start working on their second straight title when they face the 6th-seeded Chicago Bulls in the Eastern Conference first-round series starting Sunday in Milwaukee. This is WPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez.
ABC Sports presents.
Hardcore football fans in the 1980s were treated to a new league that tried to give the NFL a run for its money.
The season premiere of the United States Football League.
The USFL collapsed spectacularly after only 3 seasons. But tomorrow, the league returns. A reconstituted USFL is playing its first game since 1985. Jeff Perlman literally wrote the book on the league. It's called Football for a Buck. It recounts the birth and demise of the USFL, a demise he writes thanks in large part to a certain future U.S. president. Perlman also points to the USFL's habit of paying huge salaries to a handful of marquee players like Herschel Walker and Steve Young, but only a pittance for the rest of the league.
They would pluck as many guys as they could from the local amateur leagues. They would find guys who hadn't played in the NFL for 5 or 6 years. You know, teams like the San Antonio Gunslingers. The owner was a guy named Clint Mangus, and he had a ranch, and he signed his ranch hand to be the punter because he thought, this guy has a really good leg. He's going to be a really good punter. It didn't work out, but there was a lot of thriftiness in the old USFL. It adds to some, it makes some of the best stories in football history, but it doesn't necessarily make for great football.
Now, one of the things that a lot of NFL fans are used to, it's almost an event as big as a Super Bowl, is the NFL draft. It's at the end of April when the NFL chooses college players, and those college players don't get a choice. They don't get a choice of which team drafted them. They wind up usually just signing, and then they go on with their careers. And finally, when they become free agents, they get to pick the team they want to be with. How was the USFL different, particularly with someone, say, like Herschel Walker, who had a lot of leverage, the Heisman Trophy winner, when he eventually got to the New Jersey Generals? How were their rules different from the NFL in that respect?
Well, their rules were that they didn't really have any rules in this regard. Like they really wanted Herschel Walker. Herschel Walker called, he wanted to come out of Georgia early. At the time, the NFL would not take underclassmen. They had a strict rule against it. And Walker, you know, he came from Wrightsville, Georgia, small town, very poor family. And he wanted to come out. And he called the USFL, his agent did. And they said, where do you want him to go? And they wanted him to go to the New York market. So that was the New Jersey Generals. I mean, those drafts were fixed. Like a lot of those picks, they knew where they were going way before the draft. They knew the order of the draft. They just manipulated the market to make sure. What they really desperately wanted, honestly, is legitimacy. And they knew they had to put themselves in the best situation to sign as many marquee guys as possible.
Now, the first USFL season in 1983 had some high points. But Jeff, things started to change once they welcomed a brash young owner to their New Jersey Generals franchise. So tell us about who that was.
Donald Trump. He always wanted to be an NFL owner. Like, he desperately, desperately wanted to be in the NFL owners club. And he tried buying the Baltimore Colts at one point, failed miserably. So very early on, he has a meeting with Pete Rozelle, who was then the commissioner of the NFL. They met at a suite in the Pierre Hotel in New York City. And Donald Trump says, basically, you know, I own this team in the USFL. I don't care about this league. If you guys get me an NFL franchise, I will help you kill this league. And Pete Rozelle, to his credit, says to him, as long as I'm involved in the NFL, as long as my heirs are involved in the NFL, you, Donald Trump, will never have a team in this league.
And Donald Trump had some pretty kind of wild ideas about what he wanted to do with the league to change the league. He had some kind of plans that he thought would maybe go up against the NFL and take it down.
His plan was, I'm going to use the USFL. We're going to force a merger with the NFL. The USFL was a spring league, and he kept pushing for fall. He kept saying, it's fall, it's fall. He would manipulate figures. He would do studies and then lie about the studies, showing that fall was the way the USFL could go. It made no sense whatsoever. Why would you challenge the NFL directly? But he was very manipulative and very powerful in that owner's room, and they wound up moving to fall, trying to move to fall, and he wound up leading the USFL's death dive, which was, we're going to sue the NFL. We're going to file this antitrust suit. And what happened is the NFL, it was a crazy complicated lawsuit that the USFL actually won, but they were given $3 as a reward because what the jury decided was that, yes, the NFL was guilty of some antitrust violations, but the USFL and Donald Trump were the USFL's own worst enemy.
You know, that last season for the USFL, that last third season, and I'm a teenager at the time, so I'm not like that tuned into the business. I knew it wasn't doing well through my uncles and my dad, but I didn't know how bad until they went from playing at the L.A. Memorial Coliseum to L.A. Pierce Community College in the San Fernando Valley for their last home game. And that's when I even thought, okay, this league's in trouble.
It's a funny moment because it was the L.A. Express playing the Arizona Outlaws. And the quarterback for the Express was Steve Young. And the quarterback for the Outlaws was Doug Williams, former Tampa Bay Buccaneer star. And they're playing at this tiny little field, and nobody's there, and it's really pathetic. And at the end of the game, Young and Doug Williams, you know, meet, they shake hands. And Williams says, what the hell are we doing here? And Steve Young is like, I don't know, man. I don't know. But the funny thing is, a year later, Steve Young was playing for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, who were awful at that point. And he said he would have preferred to stick with the Express, that even they were better than the lowly Buccaneers.
I was there, Jeff. No one was there. I was there. I actually watched that game.
That's amazing.
Yeah, well, you know.
You were the one.
It was a cheap ticket. It was a cheap ticket.
That's awesome.
What can I say? Now, okay, a shiny new version of the USFL is going to be starting up again really soon, this weekend, actually. So what lessons do you think they have to learn to try to survive?
All right, so I just want to say that when people say the USFL is back, I struggle with that because – it's sort of like, let's say Kiss breaks up this year and they never perform again. And then 10 years from now, four guys put on Kiss makeup. And they're like, Kiss, we're back. Like, Kiss isn't back. It's four guys in makeup. This is not the USFL. This is a league, kind of a, I think, trying to make money quick off of spring football, TV deal on Fox league, where they're using USFL uniforms, USFL logos. I don't actually totally get why. They've shown no interest in the old league. I talked to one of the guys with the league. I was like, he hadn't read my book. And I'm not saying anyone should read my book. It was weird that a guy was starting a new USFL and didn't read the book about the USFL. I just found the whole thing. He could have bought it for a nickel. I don't care. I just thought it was weird. I love the USFL. You sound like you love the USFL. There aren't that many of us. So it's kind of weird that like they're starting a league with USFL uniforms and that's it. It almost, none of it makes any sense to me. So I don't know what to expect. It just seems really disjointed.
Jeff Perlman is the author of the 2018 book, Football for a Buck, The Crazy Rise and Crazier Demise of the USFL. Jeff, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by BJ Lederman. This music was by the original Kiss lineup. I'm E. Martinez.
I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Melissa Ingalls. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll have news updates from NPR and WPR every hour, plus more news on our website at WPR.org. It's a minute before 9, and classical music is coming up.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Second Century Endowment Fund. a board-designated endowment fund providing ongoing financial support for WPR in its second century of service to the residents of Wisconsin.
Support comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. Dementia care specialists provide free support and education for people with dementia and their caregivers to ensure quality of life while living at home. Call 262-605-6646.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.